who I am, even if you'll crucify me for it. Just like Jesus did. Yours, Sugar. A motorcycle with no one on it. Dear Sugar, I'm crushing in middle age. That's pretty much it. I'm middle-aged, married, and crushing on a friend. And it's full-blown. Just like in high school, sweaty palms, distracted, giddy, the whole shebang. So far, it has gone no further than flirting. And I really, really know better. My question isn't, what should I do? I'm pretty clear I should behave. But what should I do with all this delightful but distressing energy? Crushed. Dear Crushed, steer clear of the object of your crush and use that delightful but distressing energy to reinvest in what matters most to you, your marriage, it seems. Do something extra sweet for your spouse this week. Have sex tonight and make it hella hot and good. Go for a long walk or a lingering dinner together and lovingly discuss how you're going to keep your love as well as your romance strong. You're clear you don't want to act on your crush. So trust that clarity and be grateful that you have it. My inbox is jammed with emails from people who are not so clear. They're tortured by indecision and guilt and lust. They love X, but want to fuck Z. It is the plight of almost every monogamous person at one time or another. We all love X, but want to fuck Z. Z is so gleaming, so crystalline, so unlikely to bitch at you for neglecting to take out the recycling. Nobody has to haggle with Z. Z doesn't wear a watch. Z is like a motorcycle with no one on it. Beautiful. Going nowhere. Yours, Sugar. The Reckoning. Dear Sugar, I am the lucky mama of one darling baby. And oh, how I treasure every moment. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the baby's daddy does not follow suit on treasuring every moment. Baby's daddy lives in another state. He left while I was still pregnant and did not attend our child's birth. Though he proclaims via emails every 6 or so weeks to care for his child, he does not pay child support, nor has he seen his baby since mere weeks after birth. Our baby is now over 1. He has never even called to find out how his child is doing. My question is this. Am I obligated to send pictures and keep him updated about his child since he sends somewhat pitiful emails every couple of months about himself? I'm heavily leaning toward no updates, but I would gladly take into consideration the opinion of a lovely sweet pea such as yourself, Sugar. I want to do what is best for my little bundle. Even if what I want to do is kick the baby's daddy in the groin with steel-toed boots, screaming, "What the hell is the matter with you, you narcissistic crazy?" Whew, that felt good to say. Let the healing begin. Joy and love, dear Sugar. Oh, Mama. Dear Oh, Mama, do you own a pair of steel-toed boots? I do, and I'm happy to loan them to you, so that you can properly kick the ass of that fool. Your rage is justified. Your angry astonishment over your baby daddy's failure to be a true father to your beautiful baby makes all the sense in the world. But you know what? It doesn't matter one fig. At least not in the face of what's at stake for your child if you choose to let your perfectly reasonable fury guide the decisions you make when it comes to the way you conduct yourself on the subject of his or her father. That this man is your child's father is one of the most essential facts of his or her life. It remains a fact no matter what happens, whether the man with whom you've reproduced ever has a relationship with your child or not. One day, years from now, your son or daughter will have to account for his or her father, and for you as well. There will be a reckoning. There is always a reckoning, for every one of us. Accounting for what happened in our childhoods and why and who our parents are and how they succeeded and failed us is the work we all do when we do the work of becoming whole, grown-up people. That reckoning is especially fraught when a parent has failed a child. And so I advise you to A, do do everything in your power to thwart a fail between your child and his or her father, and B, keep yourself from failing should the father of your child persist in doing so. It's apparent that you're struggling with the rage and disappointment you rightly feel toward your baby's father. I don't fault you for this, and no one would. But what's your fault and what isn't is beside the point. The point, as you state in your letter, is what's best for your child. You asked if you were obligated to send pictures and updates in response to the intermittent emails the father of your child sends you, and my answer is yes. Not because you're obligated to the man, you owe him nothing, but because you're obligated to your child. Given the fact that baby daddy sounds like only a pathetic fuck, rather than an abusive one, the best thing you can do for your sweet baby is nurture a father-child bond, especially this early in your child's life. As you've so depressingly detailed, it hasn't begun well. Baby daddy has thus far failed on every front. This is not your responsibility, but it is your problem. Your efforts in the direction of inclusion, communication, acceptance, and forgiveness could lead to a positive relationship between your child and his or her father that profoundly affects the course of his or her life. Or not. We can't know yet. But it's a big enough deal that I strongly encourage you to try. I don't say this with a light heart. It would be much more fun to kick this guy with your steel-toed boots. I would be happy to help you do that. I understand how outrageously unjust it is that you should be expected to respond to this, quote, narcissistic crazy with grace and integrity. But every now and then, each of us must do so, honey bun, and this is your time. This is when it counts. Because, of course, you aren't doing this for you. You're doing this for your child. I know you know this already. I can tell you're a great mom. Your good momness shimmers right through your letter. And now, appallingly, I implore you to see what you can do to help the man who knocked you up to likewise shimmer. Our kids deserve that, don't they? To be loved shimmeringly? Yes, they do. So let's get to it. The first thing I advise you to do is compel baby daddy to pay child support. This can be done through peaceful legal negotiation, or you can sue his ass. Either way, I encourage you to do it through formal channels rather than personal agreement, so that you have recourse should baby daddy fail to pay. By requiring this man to contribute financially, you're not only protecting your child, but also communicating two important facts. That you expect something from baby daddy, and that he owes something to his child. If he's any sort of decent fellow, he'll hand over the dough without too much protest. If he's a good guy going through a rough patch, he'll thank you later. I encourage you to hire an attorney immediately. The second thing I advise you to do is compose an email addressed to your child's father that A, compassionately acknowledges his absence in his child's life, B, asks directly about making arrangements for a visit, C, provides an update on your child's personality and development. Attach a couple of pictures. Tell a few stories. When I say compassionately acknowledges, I mean does a little dance around the fact that baby daddy's not stepped up as a father so far. I mean gives him some room to change. I mean does not imply that you might team up with an advice columnist to kick his teeth out with some very serious steel-toed boots. I mean, be your best, most gigantic self, which sometimes, for a tiny bit, means faking it. As in, hello, baby daddy, I hope you're well. Baby is getting so big and more beautiful and amazing every day. Even though our relationship is a thing of the past, it's important to me that baby has a relationship with his or her daddy. And based on what you've written to me in your emails, I know it's important to you too. I want to set a date for a visit. The third thing I advise you to do is arrange for childcare for a few hours on a regular basis so you can go out with your coolest friends and rage with them about all the hurt and anger and befuddlement you have over the fact that a man you once slept with, the man who is biologically half of your precious child, is a complete jackass. This may seem extraneous, but it isn't. It's a vital piece of the survival puzzle. You must find a place to put your negative feelings about the father of your child. If you don't, they will rule you. Very likely what has gone down between you and baby daddy has only begun. Even if it goes well, I wouldn't be surprised if there were many times over the coming years that you'd like to throttle him. If you don't find a place to put those feelings, you may not be able to keep yourself from putting them on your child. And that's a terrible place to put them. A couple of years ago, I read the findings of a study on the effects of divorced and separated parents talking negatively about their exes in the presence of their children. I tried to locate it when I was writing this column so I could cite it properly and quote it directly, but I had no luck. That's fine, because what I remember about the study most vividly is really just one thing, that it's devastating for a child to hear one parent speak ill of the other. In fact, so much so that the researchers found it was less psychologically damaging if a parent said directly to the child, "You are a worthless piece of shit," than it was for a parent to say, "Your mother or father is a worthless piece of shit." I don't remember if they had any theories about why that was so, but it made sense to me. I think we all have something sturdier inside of us that rears up when we're being attacked, that we simply can't call upon when someone we love is being attacked, especially if that someone is our parent, half of us, the primal other, and the person doing the attacking is the other half, the other primal other. I know of what I speak. My own father was a destructive force in my life. If you made a map of my life and traced everything back, all the moves and decisions and transitions and events, my mother mustering the courage to divorce my father when I was 6 was probably the single best thing that ever happened to me. My father got my mom pregnant when they were both 19. They weren't very much in love, but abortion was illegal, and my mom wasn't willing to go away to a home for wayward girls and give her baby to someone else. So she married my father in a quickie wedding. Over the next 9 years, they had 3 children, my 2 siblings and me. And some very hard things happened. I have so many horrible stories about the years with my dad, who was often violent and mean. But those aren't the stories you need to hear. What you need to hear is how much as a child I loved him. My father. My dad. My daddy. The love I had for him was tremendous, irrefutable, bigger than my terror and sorrow. I could not keep myself from loving my dad. It was simply there. To not love him had never occurred to me, no matter how ugly it got. I hated what he did to my mom and my siblings and me. I wept and shrieked and hid, and got age-inappropriate headaches, and peed my bed way beyond the age that's normal. But he was my father, and so when my mom finally left him, I begged her to go back. I mean, I begged her, in a way I have never begged anyone for anything in all of my life. I sobbed my 6-year-old girl brains out, because I knew that if it was really over, if my mother really left my father, I would no longer have a dad. And you know what? I was right. After my parents divorced, I no longer had a dad. I've seen him 3 times since then, short visits during which sad and creepy things happened. But mostly there was nothing. No dad. There was only the great fatherless alone for years of my childhood, during which I lived in cheap apartment buildings occupied by other children of single mothers, most of whom also had little to do with their fathers. A couple of times a year, an envelope would arrive addressed in my father's hand to me and my siblings. It would be waiting for us in the mailbox when we returned from school, our mother at work. My brother and sister and I would rip those letters open with a glee so entire that a surge of something runs through my body still as I type these words. A letter from our dad. A letter from our dad. From our dad. From our dad. From our dad. But of course we should have known better. We knew better, but we couldn't bear to let ourselves know. The envelope had our names on it, but the letter inside was never for us. It was always something else, and always the same thing. A nasty and vulgar diatribe directed at our mom. How she was a whore and a welfare mooch. How he should have made her get that illegal abortion years ago. How she was a horrible mom. how he would come and get me and my siblings when she least expected it, and then she'd be sorry. Then she'd pay. Then she'd never see her children again. How would she like that? The thought of my father kidnapping me terrified me more than anything. It was with me always, the prospect of being snatched. I readied myself, playing out intricate fantasies about how my siblings and I would escape, how I'd get us all back to our mother at any cost. We'd walk across the country barefoot if we had to. We'd follow rivers and hide in ditches. We'd steal apples from trees and clothes from clotheslines. But our father never took us. He never had any intention of doing so, I realized one day when I was 27. He never wanted me, I thought, with such clarity and surprise and grief that I instantly broke into sobs. Will the father of your baby ever father his child, O Mama? We don't know. That letter hasn't been ripped open yet. Anything could be inside. People change. People make dreadful mistakes and then repair them. Men who are distant when their children are babies sometimes turn into wonderful dads. Others continue to be only more of the same. Whatever happens, you will do right by your child by keeping whatever you feel about his or her father separate from the choices you make and the actions you take in regard to his or her relationship with his or her dad. Your behavior and words will deeply impact your child's life, both how he or she feels about his or her father, and also how he or she feels about him or herself. My mother never spoke an ill word about my father to my siblings and me. She had every right to hate him, to turn us against him, but she didn't. It wasn't that she lied to us about him. We spoke often and honestly about the hard things we'd witnessed and suffered at his hands. But she didn't demonize him. She cast him as human, complicated, flawed, and capable of redemption. Which means, in spite of everything, she made it possible for me to love my father, this absent man who was half of me. When I was a child and asked her what had made her fall in love with my dad, she thought of things to tell me, even if she couldn't rightly remember them anymore. When I was a teenager and we argued about her refusal to condemn my father, she told me that she was grateful for him, because without him, she wouldn't have had my siblings and me. When I was just barely becoming a woman, and my mother knew she was going to die, she stroked my hair and told me it was okay if I wanted to reach out to my father again, that I should always be open to the possibility of forgiveness and reconciliation and change, and that doing so was not a betrayal of her, but rather evidence of the woman she'd raised me to be. It isn't fair that she had to be so kind to such an unkind man. I hope she raged about him to her coolest friends. As a single mother, and by that I mean truly a mother alone like you, O Mama, one who does not share custody or co-parent, she had to be her best self more often than it's reasonable for any human to be. And you know what's so never-endingly beautiful to me? She was. She was imperfect. She made mistakes. But she was her best self more often than it's reasonable for any human to be. And that is the gift of my life. Long after she was dead, it was her words and conduct that formed the bridge I teetered across to heal the wounds my father had made. That's the gift you have to give your child, regardless of how your baby's father decides to conduct himself, regardless if he ever steps up and becomes the father to your son or daughter he should be. It's what most of us have to give a few times over the course of our lives. To love with a mindfully clear sense of purpose, even when it feels outrageous to do so. Even when you'd rather put on your steel-toed boots and scream. Give it. You won't regret it. It will come out in the reckoning. Yours, Sugar. There's a bundle on your head. Dear Sugar, I'm in my early 20s. I've been in a serious relationship with the same guy for 6 years, on and off, the off portion taking place when I was younger. I have been very distracted and have been second-guessing the relationship for a while now, but I can't come to grips with losing this person that seems to be right for me permanently. And of course, I don't want to break his heart. Then again, I don't want to settle and have regrets later in life. I feel like we want different things out of life, and we have different interests, but I just can't decide. I've talked to him about my feelings, but to no avail. We went on a little break, but breaks never work. My biggest fear is being alone and never finding anyone that measures up. It doesn't help that my closest friends are settling down with their boyfriends and talking about marriage. Please help, Sugar. Sincerely, Scared and Confused. Dear Scared and Confused, I lived in London when I was 20. I was technically homeless and desperately broke, but I didn't have the papers an American needs to get a job in London, so I spent most of my time walking the streets, searching for coins that people had dropped. One day, a man in a business suit approached and asked me if I wanted an under-the-table job 3 days a week at a major accounting firm that has since collapsed due to corruption. Sure, I said. And this is how I became Coffee Girl 123. Coffee Girl was my actual job title. The 123 was tacked on to communicate the fact that I was responsible for providing fresh and hot coffee and tea to all the accountants and secretaries who worked on the first three floors of the building. It was a harder job than you might think. Coffee Girl, men would call as I passed them with my tray, often snapping their fingers to draw my attention their way. I wore a black skirt over white tights and a black vest over a white shirt, and I was almost always out of breath. Banned from the elevator, I had to race up and down steps in a stairwell that ran along the back of the building to get from one floor to the next. That stairwell was my sanctuary, the only place where nobody snapped their fingers and called me Coffee Girl. During my breaks, I walked down to the first floor and went outside and sat on a patch of concrete that edged the building that housed the major accounting firm that has since collapsed due to corruption. One day, while I was sitting there, an old woman came along and asked me where in America I was from, and I told her. And she said that years before, she'd visited the place in America where I'm from, and we had a nice conversation. And each day after that, she came along during the time when I was sitting on the patch of concrete, and we talked. She wasn't the only person who came to talk to me. I was in love with someone at the time. In fact, I was married to that someone. And I was in way over my head. At night, after I made love to this man, I would lie beside him and cry, because I knew that I loved him, and that I couldn't bear to stay with him, because I wasn't ready to love only one person yet. And I knew that if I left him, I would die of a broken heart, and I would kill him of a broken heart, too. And it would be over for me when it came to love, because there would never be another person who I'd love as much as I loved him, or who loved me as much as he loved me, or who was as sweet and sexy and cool and compassionate and good through and through. So I stayed. We looked for coins on the streets of London together. And sometimes he would come and visit me at the major accounting firm that has since collapsed due to corruption while I was on my breaks. One day he came while the old woman was there. My husband and the old woman had never come at the same time, but I had told him about her, detailing the conversations I'd had with her, and I had told her about him, too. "Is this your husband?" the old woman exclaimed with jubilant recognition when he walked up. And she shook his hand with both of her hands, and they chatted for a few minutes, and then she left. The man I loved was silent for a good while, giving the old woman time to walk away. And then he looked at me and said with some astonishment, "She has a bundle on her head." "She has a bundle on her head?" I said. "She has a bundle on her head," he said back. And then we laughed and laughed and laughed so hard it might to this day still be the time I laughed the hardest. He was right. He was right. That old woman, all that time, all through the conversations we'd had as I sat on the concrete patch, had had an enormous bundle on her head. She appeared perfectly normal in every way but this one. She wore an impossible 3-foot tower of ratty old rags and ripped up blankets and towels on top of her head, held there by a complicated system of ropes tied beneath her chin and fastened to loops on the shoulders of her raincoat. It was a bizarre sight, but in all of my conversations with my husband about the old woman, I'd never mentioned it. "She has a bundle on her head," we shrieked to each other through our laughter on the patch of concrete that day. But before long, I wasn't laughing anymore. I was crying. I cried and cried and cried as hard as I'd laughed. I cried so hard, I didn't go back to work. My job as coffee girl 123 ended right then and there. "Why are you crying?" asked my husband as he held me. "Because I'm hungry," I said, but it wasn't true. It was true that I was hungry. During that time, we never had enough money or enough food. But it wasn't the reason I was crying. I was crying because there was a bundle on the old woman's head, and I hadn't been able to say that there was, and because I knew that that was somehow connected to the fact that I didn't want to stay with a man I loved anymore, but I couldn't bring myself to acknowledge what was so very obvious and so very true. That was such a long time ago, scared and confused. But it all came back when I read your letter. It made me think that perhaps that moment delivered me here to say this to you. You have a bundle on your head, sweet pea. And though that bundle may be impossible for you to see right now, it's entirely visible to me. You aren't torn. You're only just afraid. You no longer wish to be in a relationship with your lover, even though he's a great guy. Fear of being alone is not a good reason to stay. Leaving this man you've been with for 6 years won't be easy, but you'll be okay, and so will he. The end of your relationship with him will likely also mark the end of an era of your life. And moving into this next era, there are going to be things you lose and things you gain. Trust yourself. It's sugar's golden rule. Trusting yourself means living out what you already know to be true. Yours, Sugar. Write like a motherfucker. Dear Sugar, I write like a girl. I write about my lady life experiences, and that usually comes out as unfiltered emotion, unrequited love, and eventual discussion of my vagina as metaphor. And that's when I can write, which doesn't happen to be true anymore. Right now, I'm a pathetic and confused young woman of 26, a writer who can't write. I am up late asking you a question, really questioning myself. I've sat here at my desk for hours, mentally immobile. I look up people I used to love and wonder why they never loved me. I lie face down on my bed and feel scared. I get up, go to the computer, feel worse. David Foster Wallace called himself a failed writer at 28. Several months ago, when depression hooked its teeth into me, I complained to my then-boyfriend about how I'll never be as good as Wallace. He screamed at me on Guerrero Street in San Francisco, "Stop it! He killed himself, Alyssa! I hope to God you're never like him." I understand women like me are hurting and dealing with self-trivialization, contempt for other, more successful people, misplaced compassion, addiction, and depression, whether they are writers or not. Think of the canon of women writers. A unifying theme is that so many of their careers ended in suicide. I often explain to my mother that to be a writer, a woman writer, means to suffer mercilessly and eventually collapse in a heap of, "I could have been better than this." She pleads with me, "Can't it be different?" Can it? I want to jump out the window for what I've boiled down to is one reason. I can't write a book. But it's not that I want to die so much as have an entirely different life. I start to think that I should choose another profession. As Lori Moore suggests, movie star slash astronaut, a movie star slash missionary, a movie star slash kindergarten teacher. I want to throw off everything I've accumulated and begin as someone new, someone better. I don't have a bad life. I didn't have a painful childhood. I know I'm not the first depressed writer. Quote, depressed writer, because the latter is less accurate. The former is more acute. I've been clinically diagnosed with major depressive disorder and have an off-and-on relationship with prescription medication, which I confide so it doesn't seem I throw around the term depression. That said, I'm high-functioning. A high-functioning head case. One who jokes enough that most people don't know the truth. The truth? I'm sick with panic that I cannot, will not, override my limitations, insecurities, jealousies, and ineptitude to write well, with intelligence and heart and lengthiness. And I fear that even if I do manage to write, that the stories I write about my vagina, etc., will be disregarded and mocked. How do I reach the page when I can't lift my face off the bed? How does one go on, sugar, when you realize you might not have it in you? How does a woman get up and become the writer she wishes she'd be? Sincerely, Alyssa Bassist. Dear Alyssa Bassist, when I was 28, I had a chalkboard in my living room. It was one of those two-sided wooden A-frames that stand on their own and fold flat. On one side of the chalkboard, I wrote, "The first product of self-knowledge is humility." Flannery O'Connor. And on the other side, I wrote, "She sat and thought of only one thing, of her mother holding and holding on to their hands." Eudora Welty. The quote by Eudora Welty is from her novel, The Optimist's Daughter, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1972. It was a book I read again and again, and that line about the woman who sat thinking of only one thing was at the heart of the reason why. I sat like that too, thinking of only one thing. One thing that was actually two things pressed together, like the back-to-back quotes on my chalkboard. How much I missed my mother, and how the only way I could bear to live without her was to write a book, my book, the one that I'd known was in me since way before I knew people like me could have books inside of them, the one I felt pulsing in my chest like a second heart, formless and unimaginable until my mother died. And there it was, the plot revealed, the story I couldn't live without telling. That I hadn't written the book by the time I was 28 was a sad shock to me. Of myself, I'd expected greater things. I was a bit like you then, Alyssa Bassist, without a book, but not entirely without literary acclaim. I'd won a few grants and awards, published a couple of stories and essays. These minor successes stoked the grandiose ideas I had about what I would achieve and by what age I would achieve it. I read voraciously. I practically memorized the work of writers I loved. I recorded my life copiously and artfully into my journals. I wrote stories in feverish, intermittent bursts, believing they'd miraculously form a novel without my having to suffer too much over it. But I was wrong. The second heart inside me beat ever stronger, but nothing miraculously became a book. As my 30th birthday approached, I realized that if I truly wanted to write the story I had to tell, I would have to gather everything within me to make it happen. I would have to sit and think of only one thing longer and harder than I thought possible. I would have to suffer, by which I mean work. At the time, I believed that I'd wasted my 20s by not having come out of them with a finished book, and I bitterly lambasted myself for that. I thought a lot of the same things about myself that you do, Alyssa Bassist, that I was lazy and lame, that even though I had the story in me, I didn't have it in me to see it to fruition, to actually get it out of my body and onto the page, to write, as you say, with intelligence and heart and lengthiness. But I'd finally reached a point where the prospect of not writing a book was more awful than the one of writing a book that sucked. And so at last, I got to serious work on the book. When I was done writing it, I understood that things happened just as they were meant to, that I couldn't have written my book before I did. I simply wasn't capable of doing so, either as a writer or a person. To get to the point I had to get to write my first book, I had to do everything I did in my 20s. I had to write a lot of sentences that never turned into anything, and stories that never miraculously formed a novel. I had to read voraciously and compose exhaustive entries in my journals. I had to waste time and grieve my mother and come to terms with my childhood and have stupid and sweet and scandalous sexual relationships and grow up. In short, I had to gain the self-knowledge that Flannery O'Connor mentions in that quote I wrote on my chalkboard. And once I got there, I had to make a hard stop at self-knowledge's first product, humility. Do you know what that is, sweet pea? To be humble? The word comes from the Latin words humilis and humus, to be down low, to be of the earth, to be on the ground. That's where I went when I wrote the last word of my first book, straight onto the cool tile floor to weep. I sobbed and I wailed and I laughed through my tears. I didn't get up for half an hour. I was too happy and grateful to stand. I had turned 35 a few weeks before. I was 2 months pregnant with my first child. I didn't know if people would think my book was good or bad or horrible or beautiful, and I didn't care. I only knew I no longer had two hearts beating in my chest. I'd pulled one out with my own bare hands. I'd suffered. I'd given it everything I had. I'd finally been able to give it because I'd let go of all the grandiose ideas I'd once had about myself and my writing. So talented, so young. I'd stopped being grandiose. I'd lowered myself to the notion that the absolute only thing that mattered was getting that extra beating heart out of my chest, which meant I had to write my book, my very possibly mediocre book, my very possibly never going to be published book, my absolutely nowhere in league with the writers I'd admired so much that I practically memorized their sentences book. It was only then, when I humbly surrendered, that I was able to do the work I needed to do. I hope you'll think hard about that, honey bun. If you had a two-sided chalkboard in your living room, I'd write humility on one side and surrender on the other for you. That's what I think you need to find and do to get yourself out of the funk you're in. The most fascinating thing to me about your letter is that buried beneath all the anxiety and sorrow and fear and self-loathing, there's arrogance at its core. It presumes you should be successful at 26. When really it takes most writers so much longer to get there. It laments that you'll never be as good as David Foster Wallace, a genius, a master of the craft, while at the same time describing how little you write. You loathe yourself, and yet you're consumed by the grandiose ideas you have about your own importance. You're up too high and down too low. Neither is the place where we get any work done. We get the work done on the ground level, and the kindest thing I can do for you is to tell you to get your ass on the floor. I know it's hard to write, darling, but it's harder not to. The only way you'll find out if you, quote, have it in you, is to get to work and see if you do. The only way to override your, quote, limitations, insecurities, jealousies, and ineptitude is to produce. You have limitations. You are in some ways inept. This is true of every writer, and it's especially true of writers who are 26. You will feel insecure and jealous. How much power you give those feelings is entirely up to you. That you struggle with major depressive disorder certainly adds a layer to your difficulties. I've not focused on it in my answer because I believe, and it seems you believe, that it's only a layer. It goes without saying that your life is more important than your writing, and that you should consult your doctor about how your depression may contribute to the despair you're feeling about your work. I'm not a doctor, so I cannot advise you about that. But I can tell you that you're not alone in your insecurities and fears. They're typical of writers, even those who don't have depression. Artists of all sorts reading this will understand your struggles, including me. Another layer of your anxiety seems rooted in your concern that as a woman, your writing, which features, quote, unfiltered emotion, unrequited love, and discussion of your vagina as a metaphor, will be taken less seriously than that of men. Yes, it probably will. Our culture has made significant progress when it comes to sexism and racism and homophobia, but we're not all the way there. It's still true that literary works by women, gays, and writers of color are often framed as specific rather than universal, small rather than big, personal or particular rather than socially significant. There are things you can do to shed light on and challenge those biases and bullshit moves. But the best possible thing you can do is get your ass down onto the floor. Write so blazingly good that you can't be framed. Nobody's going to ask you to write about your vagina, hun. Nobody's going to give you a thing. You have to give it to yourself. You have to tell us what you have to say. That's what women writers throughout time have done, and it's what we'll continue to do. It's not true that to be, quote, a woman writer means to suffer mercilessly and eventually collapse in a heap of, I could have been better than this. Nor is it true that a unifying theme is that so many of their careers ended in suicide. And I strongly encourage you to let go of those beliefs. They are inaccurate and melodramatic, and they do not serve you. People of all professions suffer and kill themselves. In spite of various mythologies regarding artists and how psychologically fragile we are, the fact is that occupation is not a top predictor for suicide. Yes, we can rattle off a list of women writers who've killed themselves, and yes, we may conjecture that their status as women in the societies in which they lived contributed to the depressive and desperate state that caused them to do so. But it isn't the unifying theme. You know what is? How many women wrote beautiful novels and stories and poems and essays and plays and scripts and songs in spite of all the crap they endured? How many of them didn't collapse in a heap of, I could have been better than this, and instead went right ahead and became better than anyone would have predicted or allowed them to be? The unifying theme is resilience and faith. The unifying theme is being a warrior and a motherfucker. It is not fragility. It's strength. It's nerve. And if your nerve deny you, as Emily Dickinson wrote, go above your nerve. Writing is hard for every last one of us, straight white men included. Coal mining is harder. Do you think miners stand around all day talking about how hard it is to mine for coal? They do not. They simply dig. You need to do the same, dear, sweet, arrogant, beautiful, crazy, talented, tortured, rising star glow bug. That you're so bound up about writing tells me that writing is what you're here to do. And when people are here to do that, they almost always tell us something we need to hear. I want to know what you have inside you. I want to see the contours of your second beating heart. So write, Elizabeth Sist. Not like a girl. Not like a boy. Write like a motherfucker. Yours, Sugar. A New, More Fractured Light. Dear Sugar, my parents recently decided to get a divorce. To be more accurate, my father left my mother for a younger woman. A cliché story, except when it happened to my family, I was shattered, as if it was the first time it had ever happened. I'm an adult. I've always been close with my father. I looked up to him as a role model. To find out he'd been seeing someone else without telling my mom, and that he'd been lying to all of us about it, was very painful. Suddenly, I can't trust this man I've always counted on and loved. I'm trying to be understanding. I imagine my father struggled, and this wasn't easy for him. I'm also angry and hurt that he's moved on so quickly and that he lied to us. I want our old relationship back, and at the same time, I feel I can't have it back because of the way I feel now. There's also the reality that he's with someone new and that he's approaching his role of being my dad differently. How do I reconnect with him in a genuine way? Signed, Dealing with Divorce. Dear Dealing with Divorce, there's nothing good about one's father leaving one's mother for anyone, but especially for a younger woman, and especially after a period of having lied about it. I'm sorry for your pain. I think you reconnect with your dad in a genuine way by being genuine. To be genuine means to be actual, to be true, to be sincere and honest. You need to tell your father how you feel about his actions and choices. You need to share your hurt and anger with him, as well as your desire to rebuild the relationship that was damaged by his dishonesty. You also need to do your best to listen to what he has to say. I can't know this for certain, but I'll guess your father didn't want to hurt you. He probably didn't want to hurt your mother either, though it sounds as if he very much did. Good people do all sorts of idiotic stuff when it comes to sex and love. Though your father's deceit feels like a personal betrayal, what happened is between him and your mom. He couldn't reveal his affair to you until he was ready to reveal it to your mother. He wasn't trying to lie to you. It's only that you got tangled up in his lies. You had an up-close view of an intimacy that ultimately did not include you. You mustn't interpret this betrayal as if it did. Just because your father proved to be undeserving of your mother's trust doesn't mean he's unworthy of yours. I know it sounds as if I'm defending your father's actions, but please let me assure you I'm not. I understand entirely why you feel the way you do. I'd be furious and hurt too. But transformation often demands that we separate our emotional responses from our rational minds. Your rational mind knows that men leave their wives for younger women all the time. Your emotional response is you can't believe that your father did. Your rational mind knows that it's hard for even strong ethical people to sustain a long-term monogamy. Your emotional response is you're shocked your own parents failed to do so. I think it would help you to lean rather hard into the rational right now. Not to deny your grief, but rather to put into perspective what seems to be the most true. Your father didn't manage to be a good husband to your mother in the end, but that doesn't mean he won't manage to be a good father to you. I encourage you to give him the opportunity. I don't think you should let him off the hook, but you should not keep him on it either. Find a way to weave your father's failing into the tapestry of your lifelong bond. Bravely explore what his new relationship means to him and ask where you fit into it. It's going to be difficult, but that's no surprise. The story of human intimacy is one of constantly allowing ourselves to see those we love most deeply in a new, more fractured light. Look hard. Risk that. Yours, Sugar. Dudes in the Woods. Dear Sugar, 3 of my best college buddies and I go away for an annual guys' weekend at a cabin in the woods. We're all in our mid-30s, and we've been doing these get-togethers for close to a decade. It's our way of staying in touch, since we've all got busy lives, and some of us reside in different cities. Though at times I'll go months without talking to them, I consider these guys my closest friends. We've seen each other through several relationships, 2 weddings, 1 divorce, 1 of us coming out as gay, 1 of us realizing he's an alcoholic and getting sober, 1 of us becoming a father, dysfunctional family issues, the death of another one of our close college friends, professional successes and failures, and you get the picture. On our most recent get-together a couple of months ago, I overheard my friends discussing me. Before this incident occurred, the 4 of us had been on the subject of my love life. My longtime girlfriend and I broke up last year for reasons I won't go into here, but I did go into with my friends back when she and I decided to end things. Not long before my weekend with the guys, she and I got back together, and I told them that my ex and I were making a go of it again. They didn't say much in response, but I wouldn't have expected them to. Later that day, I stepped out for a walk, but soon realized I'd forgotten my hat. So I returned to the cabin to get it. The moment I opened the door, I could hear my friends in the kitchen discussing me. I wasn't trying to eavesdrop, but I couldn't keep myself from listening, since they were talking about my girlfriend and me. I wouldn't say they were trashing me, but they did make critical remarks about the way I, quote, justify my relationship and other things about my personality that were unflattering. About 5 minutes into this, I opened the door and shut it hard so they would know I was there, and they stopped talking. I tried to pretend I hadn't heard what they'd said, but soon I told them what had happened. They were extremely embarrassed. Each of them apologized, assured me they meant nothing by what they said, and claimed they were only concerned that I'd gotten back together with my girlfriend, who they don't think is good for me. I played it off like it was cool and acted like I wanted to let bygones be bygones, but it's been 2 months and I'm still bothered by what happened. I feel betrayed. It's none of their business who I choose to date, for one thing, and for another, I'm pissed they were running me down like that. I recognize that I'm possibly taking this too hard. I'll admit that I've talked about each of them with the others over the years. I've made statements I wouldn't want the person in question to hear, even secondhand. The rational part of me understands that these sorts of discussions among friends are to be expected. It sounds weak to admit this, but I'm hurt. Part of me wants to tell them to go fuck themselves when it comes to the weekend at the cabin next year. What do you think? Should I forgive and forget, or find a new batch of buddies? Odd Man Out. Dear Odd Man Out, what a disaster. How dreadful it must have been to hear your friends saying negative things about you. How mortified they must have felt when they learned you'd been listening. You have every reason to be upset and hurt. And yet, you knew there was going to be an and yet, didn't you? In the scheme of things, this is quite small, quite ordinary. I'm positive you should not toss these friends aside for a new batch of them. Besides, those new friends, they'd only talk about you behind your back, too. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Perhaps the first step in getting over this is to acknowledge that what happened was indeed deeply unfortunate. By hearing what you were not meant to hear, you punctured a social code that's in place to protect your feelings. You heard your friends express opinions about you that they are too polite to tell you, and they expressed them in blunt language they would not have used had they known you were listening. You witnessed a discussion that was being had about you that was unbound by concern for your feelings. No wonder you feel so stung. Anyone would. That your friends have those opinions, however, does not mean that they don't love you or value you as a friend, or otherwise think you're one of the best people they know. That may be difficult to believe at this moment, when your feelings are so raw, but it's true. We talk about our friends behind their backs. We do. Ask any social scientist who has studied human communication behaviors. Even you admitted to doing this. Our friends are witness to our attributes and flaws, our bad habits and good qualities, our contradictions and our contrivances. That they need to occasionally discuss the negative aspects of our lives and personalities in terms less than admiring is to be expected. Like anything, there are healthy and constructive ways to do this, and unhealthy and destructive ways. A healthy way is rooted in respect and love. In this case, we make critical assessments and uncomplimentary observations entirely within the context of our affection and concern for the individual in question. Sometimes we talk behind a friend's back in order to grapple with our doubts about or disapproval of the choices he or she has made. Sometimes we do it because our friends possess qualities that confound, confuse, or annoy the shit out of us, though we love them anyway. Sometimes we discuss our friends with others because we had a weird or rude or dumb interaction with one of them, and we simply need to blow off steam. The baseline of these discussions is a grounded knowledge that we love and care for the friend, regardless of the things that irk, confuse, or disappoint us about him or her. The negative thoughts we express about this friend are outweighed by the many positive thoughts we have. An unhealthy way to talk about a friend behind his or her back is rooted in cruelty and ill will. There's a lack of generosity and a cutting glee. One takes pleasure in ripping the so-called friend to shreds. Though we may pretend otherwise, we don't truly want good things for him or her. We're judgmental and petty. We will not protect that friend, but are instead willing to betray him or her if the situation serves us. On the other hand, we are happy to use this, quote, friendship to our advantage, should the opportunity arise. Our affection is one of convenience, rather than heart. So, there's a good way and a bad way to gossip, but either way, it pretty much sucks to overhear it if you happen to be the subject of the conversation. There's no question that given what happened, Odd Man Out, you and your friends are going to have to repair a bit of damage. I believe that with some time, you can do that. I have no doubt that your friends were discussing you from a place of love and concern, the healthy place. My hunch is that your friends were unconsciously attempting to strengthen their bond with you rather than rend it when they were discussing you that day at the cabin. After all, when this incident occurred, you just informed them that you'd reunited with a woman they all apparently believe, fairly or not, is a negative force in your life. If they didn't care about you, they wouldn't have bothered to discuss this turn of events. Because they do care about you, they began speaking about it the moment they believed you were out of earshot. Collectively, they hashed out their feelings, in preparation, perhaps, to share a watered-down version of them with you. This is because they love you. You heard things you should not have heard. They said things they would not have said if they'd known of your presence. But it doesn't mean they betrayed you. It means only that you all got caught in an embarrassing situation that I'll guess every last one of us can imagine being on both sides of. I suggest that you talk to your friends again about what happened, only this time you do it more forthrightly. No doubt your hurt feelings are lingering in part because you so quickly attempted to brush them aside. Let this dudes in the woods debacle bring you closer to your friends rather than force you apart. Use this awkward experience as an opportunity to clear the air on the subject of your girlfriend and whatever it is your dearest friends think you're justifying about your relationship with her. Tell them how hurt you were to hear what they said. Tell them why you think they are wrong. Tell them why you love your girlfriend and why they should be open to loving her too. Then ask them why they said what they did about you and her, and do your best to listen. Your choice of romantic partners is none of their business, it's true. But the reason they have an opinion about it is because they want you to have a good life. They know you. They have listened to what you've told them about your relationship with this woman, and they've made their own observations. I'm not suggesting that you dump your girlfriend because your friends don't like her, but rather that you hear what they have to say. Perhaps they have a negative opinion of her, because when you broke up with her and shared the story of that breakup with your friends, you cast her in an inaccurately unflattering light. Perhaps they simply don't know what they're talking about, and you need to set them straight. Perhaps they see something you cannot see right now, blinded as you may be by desire for this relationship to work. We can't know. Time will tell. But I encourage you to swallow your pride and hear your friends out, to look at the image of yourself they're reflecting back to you. It might be useful. It might piss you off. It might help you get over the tender feelings you have about what happened at the cabin. The complicated thing about friends is that sometimes they are totally wrong about us, and sometimes they are totally right, and it's almost always only in retrospect that we know which is which. I have this dear friend I'll call Beth. She fell in love fast and hard with a guy I'll call Tom. Over the course of a year or two, Tom took Beth on a ride of highs and lows. There was love, deception, abandonment, lies, passion, promises, and a whole bunch of absolute bullshit. She was up. She was down. She was standing on my front stoop shaking and crying, or calling me to say how amazing Tom was. When I'd been witness to this relationship long enough that I'd formed my own opinion about it, I began sharing my concerns with Beth. I was gentle at first, but before long I could not keep myself from telling her exactly what I thought in the most blunt terms. This man was a player, and by not ridding herself of him entirely, she was only bringing pain upon herself. It took another several months and false starts and betrayals before she believed I was right. By then she'd wished she'd listened to what I'd said way back when, but the thing is, I didn't blame her. I wouldn't have listened either. Who does what a friend tells her to do? I can't say I ever have, even when later I fully recognized that I should have. Several months later, Beth began dating another guy. I'll call him Dave. About a month into their relationship, she called me up and told me they were engaged. "To be married?" I stuttered, trying to conceal my disapproval and fear that this Dave person was going to be another disaster, another Tom. "Yes, I know it's fast, but we're in love and we're getting married," she said. She was sure. He was great. She was so happy. She knew this was right. I spent a half hour asking her one question after another in a tone of voice that I hoped sounded upbeat, but when I hung up, I didn't feel upbeat. I felt worried. I immediately emailed another of Beth's close friends, a woman with whom I'm only acquainted. I asked her what she thought about this crazy business of Beth getting married to this guy she'd only been dating for a month. We went back and forth, discussing Beth. We shared with each other her tendencies when it came to men, our observations of her strengths and her weaknesses, the things we hoped for her and also feared. We knew her. We loved her. We wanted her to be happy, but we were talking shamelessly about her behind her back. Months later, after Beth married Dave, After I realized Dave really did make Beth happy, and that he was good not just to her, but for her, I told her what I'd done. I told her how I'd